much excitement was caused by a report of death from starvation in one. He's describing a famine in Madras here. One of the most frequented streets of the city being Madras. A villager and his family had wandered into the town. These were without food for several days. Two of the children died and were buried. Then the man died of absolute want in the sight of thousands of bags of grain. And this is a very typical scene. But this kind of analysis, Victorian analysis, that sees famine as a direct result of structural dynamics of British imperialism in India was not very common, although it had significant weight. And I want to look at that a bit. To embark down this route would mean fundamentally opposing colonialism, imperialism, and capitalism at the same time, and to recommend that Britain gave up its global geopolitical prominence and the enrichment of its ruling classes at home. It would mean raising certain fundamental questions, not about the occasional aberrations, failures, or deviations, but about the very essence of what was known as Britishness, modernity, progress, etc. On the other hand, what emerges time and again in Victorian interpretations of the imperial famines is a hesitant but nagging realization that these cataclysms did reveal something uncomfortably real about not only British-ruled India, but about Victorian modernity itself, that is, about Britain itself. The Victorian writings about famine emerges as an intensely contested ground where debates about selves and others were staged. Now, I want to just briefly look at, I'll skip some of the stuff because I really want your feedback on this, but I want to look at the samples of that Victorian debate about selves and others through the lens of famine in the next section. The famines that repeatedly devastated India predictably concentrated English minds on issues of governance, economy, technology, culture, in short, a whole gamut of issues that were bracketed under the concept of modernity. Was there a causal link between British presence and famines in India? This is the question they come back to again and again. If so, what could be said about what quickly came to be spoken as the essential British and Indian natures? How did colonial and imperial dispensation compare to the native regimes? Such were the various questions raised in Victorian famine debates. And there are three or four major strands. I'll give you examples of each. Commentators, for example, this is the first and I suppose most dominant strand of the debate. Commentators repeatedly and stoutly denied that famines were signs of British misgovernance in India. As Philindus put it in an article on the famines of South India, India had grown richer and more stable under colonial rule. As far as the eye could reach, there was nothing but a sheet of rice fields under artificial irrigation, writes in an article in 1878. Such are the changes that which a century of peace and order has induced on the physical features on the part of Hindustan, the vastness of India, whose ancient forests, especially mentioned in the Ramayans. Even in the depths of the killing time of the famine, writers could praise the promptitude and liberality, the generous and humane feelings of the British government, which gave the local magistrates ready permission to make distributions from the public treasury to any amount within limit for the employment of the destitute on the works of public utility. Such liberal and progressive governance was often, so famine becomes this occasion of restating the credences of empire. This is a natural calamity, we are doing our best, and indeed this is the only way to combat this. Such liberal and progressive governance was often contrasted to the Indian tyrannies of the past and not so distant past. There's a big survey by someone called C.R. Girdleston, for instance, of North Indian famines, contained lurid details of the alleged misdemeanors of medieval Indian rulers, or in any pre-British Indian rulers, really. In this case, someone called Mohammed bin Tughlaq. Not content, too, with this drain on the agricultural population, he on more than one occasion ordered the troops as though for a wild beast chase, but really with a view to kill unfortunate villagers whose only fault was that they could not satisfy his arbitrary demands. So things have changed since then, argues Girdleston. This is what we have done. We don't do it perfectly, but we do it much better than Mohammed Tughlaq, for instance. Writing of a much more recent and traumatic Indian misdemeanor, such as the Great Mutiny of 1857, Colonel Baird Smith saw the occupation of Delhi and its vicinities by the rebel Indian troops as a key factor in the development of the famine conditions in northern India in 1860-61. As you know, post-1857, after the Great Mutiny, about for the next two or three years, the whole entire tracts of North India suffered famine conditions. Here, the blame is very squarely put on the Indian mutineers and not on the British liberating forces there. So there are many examples of this, and the basic argument is, yes, we are not perfect, but this is a huge improvement on what had gone on before or what would go on if India was left to Indians. But if India was blessed with a firm or humane British rule, then clearly something else was at the root of these repeated famines. One get-out clause, obviously, was to see this as an imperfection in the native material that the British rulers were working with, the Indians themselves. Girdlestone tells the story of an Indian village, Tehsildar, which is a government-appointed post, who, when entrusted with the management of famine relief work, failed to employ a single person for 8 days, despite people dying of hunger around him, because all those 8 days in question were holidays. So there, he has a number of these anecdotes. Look what we have to work with. These are the people we have to work with. Others saw the backward nature of India's feudal rulers as being the major obstacle to achieving thorough reform in every corner of the country that would banish famine. The Westminster Review, for instance, compared them to ancient European lords such as King Bombolino, but the animal now is fortunately as extinct in Western Europe as compared to the innocent cave hyena, but of course they're still present in India. Still, others blamed the apparently deeply entrenched Indian social cultural practices such as caste. The great ally of famine, the great minister of death, was the prejudice of caste, ran a typical pronouncement in the Edinburgh Review. Despite such a ready-made explanation for Indian backwardness and incompetence, not all Victorians, as I've hinted before, were prepared to believe that famines had nothing to do whatsoever with any kind of British failure. One popular suggestion that it was the very excess of humane concerns and the spread of peace and order that was the problem. So, Britain has brought peace to India, but this peace has made Indians lazy, and so on. That the Indian peasants without any... So they go on to suggest that the Indian peasants without any help from the government must be compelled to create an extensive canal system as a preventative measure against famines. Philinders, again, suggests that soft British rule had created a habit of reflexive dependency amongst the Indians. And it was this deplorable habit that exacerbated the effects of the excess or lack of rainfall to full-blown famine. So good government equals lazy subjects equal famine. Further evidence of this damaging dependency on soft governance was found in the resistance of the famine-struck Indians to undergo what was called the distance test in order to qualify for relief measures. Mike Davison's book, El Niño, what is it called? Victorian Apocalypse? What's it called? Anyway, I forgot. I mean, his book on the 19th century famines and the making of the third world has lists this particular section.